This is Jim Menick, and the topic I want to talk about today is sovereignty. This subject comes up all the time in debate, or I wish it came up all the time, let's put it that way, but it has very specifically come up in a topic in March, April, and I figure a general background on sovereignty might be useful in a lot of other cases going down the line. And I wrote up a little piece on sovereignty, and I published it in my blog. But I felt this may be the sort of thing, you know, once you write something in the blog, I wrote it in the blog, and the people who were debating that topic at that time read it or ignored it or did whatever they wanted to do about it, and it just goes away. But if I put it into a podcast, it would be there for the duration. And maybe in the future, somebody could go back and take a listen and just get a general idea of what the concept of sovereignty is all about. I don't offer positions or ideas on how to argue. I don't even talk about the specific resolution that got me to talk about this in the first place. I just want to outline a general sense of what sovereignty is all about. The concept of sovereignty is very ephemeral, so its exercise and protection are similarly ephemeral. Governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. That's how Tom Jefferson put it. For that matter, governments also derive their unjust powers, if any, from the consent of the governed. In other words, you can torture this concept quite a bit to explain that even dismal totalitarian governments with brutal dictators acting as overlords of a police state are deriving their powers from the consent of the governed, even though in those cases that consent may be coerced. At the point where there is no consent, yet the government remains empowered, we could actually have a situation where overthrow of the government by outside agency is justified. But that's a big question that requires strong analysis that I'm not going to go into here. The point at the moment is that the power of a government is derived from the people governed, regardless of the form of the government. If you stick to the concept of just powers in the Jeffersonian, and of course preceding that, the Lockean sense, or of just government period, questions of legitimacy are removed, and we have a fairly acceptable proposition. According to this logic, any group of people with an accepted leadership is some sort of government. True enough. Any sizable group of people tends to have some sort of governing body. School districts have school boards, towns have town councils, corporations have boards of directors, clubs have presidents. Maintaining order usually requires some sense of governance, of rules being made and enforced. Anarchy has never been proven to be an effective mode of production of much of anything. It is, in effect, a human version of Brownian motion, and it's hardly likely to make the trains run on time. As you can see, the concept of nation is not inherent in the concept of governance. If all sorts of groups can have governing bodies, which are the groups then that we would consider nations? Webster's 11th edition gives a most question-begging definition by citing nationality as number one. Thanks a lot. After that, they hedge so much you wouldn't want to bet that the sun is rising in the east tomorrow, according to their explanations. I think there are a number of factors that make a group of people into a nation. The existence of a government is indeed one of those things. If, say, Australia had no government, and all the Aussies ran around in total anarchy doing whatever they pleased, you would be hard-pressed to consider them a nation, despite the fact that they inhabit a clearly delineated territory. This would mean, then, that territory alone does not define a nation. But territory does seem to be something of a requirement. Some territories are clearly defined due to geographical details, like Australia. You know, the geographical details could be mountains and rivers and oceans that make nice delineators from one nation to another. Other territories are simply agreed to. For example, the 49th parallel between the U.S. and Canada. And many territories are fought over regardless of how clear the boundaries might be. In any case, a nation needs, at least, both a government and territory to be perceived as a nation. What else? What other factors make a group of governed people in a delineated space a nation, and not just an organized accident of geography? Well, I for one would throw in culture and all the things that comprise culture. A culture need not be homogeneous. Certainly the United States is both a nation and culturally diverse. But there do have to be strong commonalities, a shared value set, shared history, probably shared language. Brussels may be a nation, but its language split makes it also a fairly anomalous headache. For the sake of argument, at least for the sake of Lincoln Douglas' argument, you might find this regardless of the topic, that area of shared value set may be the most important. So now we begin to see a well-rounded concept of nation, with territory, government, and a shared psyche, if you will, with variants from nation to nation of the literal elements of the psyche, just as there are variants in the size and shape of the territories and the nature of the governments. Holding it all together is the belief among the people in this territory, with this government, and with this shared psyche, that they are indeed a nation. They could think of themselves as something else, which need not concern us, but at the point at which they consider themselves a nation, they declare their sovereignty. That they are a nation. And that sovereignty is the power of that nation over itself, and the connection of that nation with the other nations in the world. If the American colonies wish to declare their independence from Great Britain, for example, they'd better be ready to conduct themselves as members of the global community. But additionally, the other members of the global community must be ready to accept the colony's nationhood or any group's nationhood. That is, half of the deal is claiming to be a nation. The other half is being recognized as a nation by the pre-existing nations. Much of the history we study in schools is the conflict of sovereignties either within their borders or establishing their existence. Who's in charge here? And why are you where I want to be? Remove this kind of study from history and there's nothing left except what Louis XIV was wearing the night he learned the tango from Adam Sandler's mother-in-law. Speaking of Adam Sandler's mother-in-law, but speaking of the colonies and declaring their sovereignty and getting that sovereignty recognized by the rest of the world, go back and look at the Declaration of Independence, which is the document that the colonies do that exactly through. Establishing a nation's sovereignty is tantamount to empowering it to exist. A nation's sovereignty is its inherent power. A nation's power is its sovereignty. Sovereignty for a nation is the same as autonomy for a nation, and is certainly analogous to autonomy for an individual. We wish to have autonomy means that we wish to have sovereignty over ourselves. A nation's claim of sovereignty is a claim of autonomy. which leads to the obvious conclusion that any abridgment of a nation's sovereignty is an attack on its autonomy, an attack which may or may not be justified, of course. Now, that pretty much sums it up. Now, you could demur from any point or two here and there in what I've said, and you might want to put it a different way. But I think this comes pretty close. And not understanding this concept of sovereignty, or saying that sovereignty is, in fact, something else altogether, will probably not put you in good stead, regardless of what topic you have to be debating. So I hope this has helped make it a little bit clearer if, in fact, you are sort of floundering about trying to figure what sovereignty ought to be.